Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
A hired gun is an assassin, the best available musician that gets hired to go on tour to deliver that music for that artist. Nobody will know who he is, but he gets the gig because he's the elite player.
Seems like there's about 20 musicians we're talking about that have made every single record that everybody owns.
There's always somebody standing by ready to take your place if things aren't going well, that's for sure.
Job security was my awesomeness.
You have to be even more focused than somebody who's permanently in a band, because what you're doing today reflects on what you're going to be doing tomorrow.
Great all the time because you're entertaining the name. And if you're not great tonight, you may lose your gig tomorrow.
We know the riffs that they played on guitar or piano or saxophone, but we don't know their face or their name.
Being a hired gun, you're sitting in the front row to a very glamorous, high-profile, exciting lifestyle, but it has nothing to do with you.
Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, folks, welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. This episode's a cool one for me, and I think it's going to be for you, especially for those of you who are, either putting out new product or maybe in need of representation or have thought about getting representation. But We're very lucky to be talking to one of the associate producers for a great movie that is currently on Netflix that if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you check it out. It's really interesting. It's very educational. At the same time, it's gut-wrenching. I know a lot of the folks who are in that movie, and hearing their story on a deeper level was even more gut-wrenching. The movie's called Hired Gun, and we have with us associate producer and legal counsel, Mr. T. Michael Kennedy. How are you?
I'm doing great, Mark.
Do you like to go by T or Michael?
Michael is great.
Okay.
Michael is good. Okay. I'm not a Mike. That's one of those things you sing into, so.
Okay. So how was your, we're going to talk a lot about you as a musician as well, because I know you're a guitar nut, just like the rest of us. You're a music fiend, as you said in a previous conversation that you and I had. But, how does someone, like you, a legal counsel, get involved as an associate producer for a movie?
Well, this was a really nice thing to fall into, for lack of better description. Jason Hook and I have been good friends for a number of years. He's the executive producer of Hired Gun, and of course, he's the lead guitarist for Five Finger Death Punch. And Jason and I met several years ago in Italy, of all places, when he was lead guitarist for Alice Cooper. And we became good friends. And as the friendship grew, him knowing that I was a lawyer and did some artist representation, he started asking me to look at some things for him, mostly band related. And as that relationship started to grow, I became his personal lawyer for everything, you know, everything band related, outside interests, investments, businesses, things of that nature. I'm kind of the due diligence guy.
Right.
And, you know, as he likes to say, hey, send it to Michael. You know, I don't sign off on anything unless he does. So this hired gun was an idea that Jason had and said, you know, I think this is a story that needs to be told. And there was a guy who was with the band at the time who was doing a lot of the video chronicling of the band, a guy by the name of Fran Strein, and he was the director of Hired Gun. And over the course of many months, a lot of planning went on to further this idea. And once that happened, Jason said, well, how are we going to go about this? And I said, well, you know, we need to form a corporation, obviously. And so I set about and I did that. And then we started to put the pieces in place. And as it turned out, I ended up overseeing a lot of the project. I did a lot of legal work on the project. I learned a lot, definitely about movie making. My previous experience had been really pretty much limited to the music realm with artists and artist representation. And it was an eye-opening experience. As I like to say, it is probably a small project by Hollywood standards, but an incredible amount of work and a big number of people go into the whole thing.
It's a great film. It's incredibly educational, and you know, and it's interesting, you know, that Jason would have wanted to do this, and I would love to talk to him about it at some point. It's really interesting because, you know, he definitely made some mistakes there on the way. And,
absolutely,
you know, like going ahead and like, you know, okay, I got this gig, I'm going to go buy a house. And like, that was, that was the worst thing he could have possibly done, because, you know, it's, you know, eventually it's going to dry up. You're only as good as your last gig, as they say in the movie, all through that movie. Every single one of those players in there says it. I mean, from Phil X to Kenny Aronson, and, you know, so it's great that he was cognizant enough to realize, wow, you know, this is a, like you said, this is a story that needs to be told, because there are so many other people that are coming up right now. And I thought it was great that Nita was in there, because she's probably one of the newest of those ranks that have come in, you know,
and she's really stretched out too, Mark. I saw her, probably about a month ago here in Dallas.
Yeah.
Breeze. When she's not touring with Alice, she's got her own solo stuff going on now. Mm-hmm. And she was here in Dallas with Angel Vivaldi and another really, really good player, a friend of mine. His name is Adam Nanez. He opened. And Nita's the whole package. You know, she's beautiful. She's got killer chops, and she's forget gender. She's a great guitar player.
Well, she can play any style too. I mean, it's interesting because most people know her as this, you know, when she was with the Iron Maidens, right? And then, and then, you know, so she played that kind of music, and then she plays with Alice, and it's very shreddy, you know, and she's, you know, she's known for that. But man, let me tell you, she can play anything. And that's what I'm always looking for. I'm looking for musicians. I'm always looking at musicians who are multifaceted, because that's where it's at. That's when you know they're realizing their full potential.
Yeah, exactly. And Jason's one of those guys too. You know, he's a chameleon.
Oh, yeah.
He, you know, he crawls across the border, as he likes to say, and goes to L.A. and does the, you know, base room apartment thing, trying out for any gig he can find.
Yeah.
He ended up being an acoustic guitar player for Mandy Moore, and then he goes to Hilary Duff, and then he goes right from there to Vince Neil, and
right,
you know. With Ace Frehley for a while, it's like he can play anything.
Yeah, and then Alice, and then Five Finger, and Five Finger is like, that is like on a whole nother level of heavy, you know. So it's really, it's amazing, and it's really, it's refreshing too. I mean, every one of the people that in that movie, really, I mean, you think about it, I mean, you look at everybody from Liberty DeVito and Kenny Aronson and Phil X, and Phil X is another guy, you know, all the way as far back as, I mean, before the Drills, when he was doing the Fretted Americana videos.
Yeah.
You know, which I couldn't wait every week. I couldn't wait for another one. I was like, oh, my God, what is he going to play? You know, let's see. Let's watch him do some Deep Purple. Let's watch him do some, you know, whatever the guitar brought out in him. It was fantastic. So they're so multifaceted. And it really shows that that's the kind of player you really need to be if you are going to be a side guy. You know, if you're going to be that side person, or you're going to be a studio cat, or whatever it's going to be, you've got to have it all. You know,
it's getting to talk to some of these guys, you get a further flavor for that. Mm-hmm. Mark, two examples come to mind. You know, one is Kenny, who is an absolute workaholic. You know, mm-hmm, most yeah. people don't consider guys in that style as being schooled musicians. Kenny went to Juilliard yeah. and was a graduate of Juilliard mm-hmm. and was practicing 8 and 9 hours a day in addition to going to school, and practicing everything percussion, not just drums, but, you know.
No, vibes. I've seen him play vibes. I've seen him play glockenspiel. I mean, yeah, all of it.
He tabs out everything, writes everything out, scores it out. And he was talking, and Ray Parker was talking. Back in the day, sometimes they'd go to 3 and 4 studios a day.
Yeah.
Different gig, different piece of music, right. different genre.
Right.
And they're expected to sit down and say, this is what I need. And play it and get it done in a day
yeah.
or two.
Well, yeah, I look at guys like him as the next generation of, you know, of the Wrecking Crew. You know, Tommy Tedesco and Hal Blaine and then of course, you know, then later on Larry Carlton and cats like that, and then Lukather, right? So those are the cats that that, you know, we hear on every freaking record on the radio.
Yeah, known to man. And you know, Luke even, he talks about that in the movie. And there are a lot of guys out there that never get credited for the work they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that a lot of the public doesn't know. They don't know that they might be listening to an Aerosmith record,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, Joe may not be on every single track,
mm-hmm.
and Brad may not be on every single track. Somebody else might be playing on it, and you're a liner note guy. So,
yeah.
I know that.
Yeah. And
you read the liner notes, you go, I didn't realize that guy played on that record.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had Steve Hunter on the show. And, you know, that goes back as far as their second record, Aerosmith, right? I mean, you know, Joe and Brad aren't even on playing on Train Kept a Rollin'.
And that goes way back in the day.
Yeah, a second record.
Interesting anecdote. I'm going to be dating myself here.
Yeah, go for it.
But when I was a sophomore in high school, we were putting together the senior prom, and I was on the committee as the sophomore representative. And in the running for the band for the prom was a band from Boston by the name of Aerosmith. And we had we had, I think it was, which was a lot of money back in the mid 70s, a $2,500 budget for the entire prom. And Aerosmith wanted like $2,000. And so we had to rule them out, but they hadn't popped yet. And
was the first record out yet?
No.
Oh, okay. So they were doing, yeah, they were doing Peter Green Fleetwood Mac covers at that point.
And Dream On was in the repertoire, but it hadn't been released yet.
Right.
So, yeah, we almost had Aerosmith for our high school prom.
That would have been a trip. That's so great. So when the movie when Hired Gun finally got released, it must have been very gratifying for everybody involved, because that really is a labor of love. Because you really don't know if something like that is going to be, like, if anybody's even going to be interested in that, because it's kind of a niche, right?
It is. You know, a lot of people say, "Oh, Wrecking Crew." It's like, no, it really isn't Wrecking Crew. That was basically a band of studio cats, and right, they were the Wrecking Crew. Right. They went in as a group and played on all of these great records. It's more a piece out of 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in the back line. I think she's the only backup singer that has ever been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. But there are those types of pieces in there. And some guys are very content with playing in obscurity, and you know, they don't mind not sharing the limelight. And then other people go on to become rock stars in their own right, like mm-hmm. Jason, Zach Wilde is another one.
Yeah.
Nita is more the new breed. She's really up and coming now. And so we wanted to make sure that we captured those different angles of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a tough road, and it takes timing. It takes good representation. It takes a good brand, and you've got to work it. You know, it is not going to come to you at all. Yeah. I mean, you're in Austin, and you can go anywhere in Austin any night of the week and see a dozen great guitar players. But who out of that dozen is going to make it? Maybe nobody.
Yeah. Especially now, you know, I mean, especially now, you know, with more and more, you know, published essays and reports being put out there about that the guitar is no longer a lead instrument and it's becoming more ornamental in the musical landscape of popular music. And it's like, well, you know, on this show, it's certainly not ornamental. Strictly. No. For everybody who listens and everybody involved producing this show, it is a very, very much a lead instrument and upfront and in your face. But yeah, it's interesting. Like you said, I think it's, you know, for guitar players that are up and coming, it's they're really, the deck is really stacked against them.
Yeah, it really is. And some of the listeners may know, some may not, but part of the reason that Gibson ended up going into bankruptcy, part of the reason, there were a lot of other things involved, was that I believe it was from 2016 to 2017 or 17 to 18, their unit sales went down from 1.5 million to about 1 million.
Yeah.
And that's a significant drop. I mean, kids aren't picking up instruments. Mm-hmm. That's been one of the big observations. You know, my son, he's a gamer, he's a musician, but he likes listening to EDM and rap. That's because that's what's in the background of everything he does.
Right. Yeah.
So you look at that and you go, well, where's the need for the guitar? Well, that's precisely the issue.
Yeah.
You know, we need that. Mm-hmm. And I get into arguments all the time with people on a couple of music pages because we can't have this interview not at least mention Greta Van Fleet.
Oh, no.
You know, and people are like, oh, they're Zeppelin, they're ripoff. I hate the kid's voice, yada, yada, yada. It's like, yeah, you're missing the point. They are selling out arenas all over the world.
I know.
And they have a following of their own age group. Like my son's age group yeah. are listening to old school rock and roll, which is the brand they play.
Right.
And the more you listen to them, sure, they've copied Zep and they admit it. And they're like, let's move on from the comparison. But they also do have their own sound. The more you listen to them, I had an opportunity to see him live.
Yeah.
And as good as the studio stuff is, they're as good a live band as any out there. They really are.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, that's really important.
Yeah. They are fabulous musicians for their ages, 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And they've got a chemistry. Of course, three of them are brothers. But they're what we need right now to keep it alive, I guess, for lack of better description. I like the band. I like what they're doing. It doesn't bother me that they're Zeppelin-esque or anything like that because, hey, you know, Zepp, they're 30 years old now. You know, they're not touring anymore. And, you know, even Plant is like, yeah, they're cute. but he doesn't diss them the way a lot of people do. I know a lot of people that really don't like them. And like I said, I think they're missing the point. They're relevant and, you know, they're playing a style of music that we need more of.
Well, I'm definitely in that category. I have to admit, I you know, when I first heard them, I was just like, come on, really? Because here's my take on it. They are, you know, and I actually wrote a blog about this. And you can go to guitarradioshow.com and type in Greta Van Fleet and you'll find it.
Okay.
And what I said was, they are incredibly talented musicians. I totally can see that. You can't deny it. I don't care how much, you know, the whole Zeppelin thing really, grinds your gears,
yep.
You know, but you can't deny these guys really know how to play their instruments, which is why I felt like, okay, if you're this good, why do you have to cop a style that close to make your musical point? That was my only issue, you know, because being a very big Zeppelin fan, that, you know, I mean, you know, that's how I ended up getting the blues, learning about the blues was through Zeppelin, and then realizing, oh wow, okay, Jimmy Page was one of the greatest plagiarists of all time, let me go back and look at everything he stole. And you know, well, okay, he paid tribute to. So maybe we can say the same thing about Greta Van Fleet. Maybe they are just basically, I mean, you know, maybe that is their rationale. Maybe they're saying, well, Zeppelin did it to somebody, you know, did it to Willie Dixon, did it to Muddy Waters, you know,
right.
Did it to Hound Dog Taylor, you know, and Blind Lemon Jefferson. Let's do it to Led Zeppelin.
You know, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer to it either. But I will say this, that when they do play live, in addition to their original stuff, they do a fair amount of covers. And they run the gamut from traditional blues stuff, and they put their own stamp on it. They're a really, really fabulous band live. I would go see them again in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think they're really talented musicians. I really do. So, you know, and it wasn't until just now, as I was saying it to you, that maybe that was their rationale. Maybe that's what they've been thinking along. And you know what? I'd be okay with that. I'd be better with that than just them saying, you know, well, this is what we do, and we're, you know, I'd be so okay if they were to say, well, Zeppelin did it to these guys, so we're doing it to Zeppelin.
Own it.
Yeah, I would be so thrilled with that kind of honesty and transparency that I would say, okay, I'm going to buy every single record you ever make. That would make me feel a little bit better. I don't know. It's just, I, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the first time I heard the Black Crowes. I said to myself, that very first song, oh, it was a Jealousy. The first time I heard Jealousy, I said, Oh, Rod Stewart and the Faces returns.
Exactly.
You know?
And then you hear them, and the more you hear them, you go, yeah, I kind of get that. But no, they have their own style.
No, and they do. They have their own, they ended up with their own thing. They ended up actually melding that kind of vibe with, you know, with Wilson Pickett, Spencer Davis, and the Dead, which is insane. And it worked.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, Rich Robinson is a fabulous guitar player.
Oh,
and I guess on that subject, clearly he ripped off Keith Richards.
Well, and what about, you know, I like to call him Mark Effin' Ford. I mean, holy crap. Mark is amazing. I mean, he doesn't get nearly enough credit for what he brought to that band.
Yeah.
I mean, just incredible guitar player. And his solo records are fantastic. So good.
Yeah, yeah. We need more of them. We need more of them.
Well,
you're
getting
Black Crowes and Greta Van Fleet, too. You know, they have that element.
Yeah, yeah, I could hear that, too. Yeah, and I hear what you're saying, and I agree with you in that, yes, we do need more of that. We absolutely do. There are some really amazing guitar records that have come out thus far in 2019 that I feel are just going to be, you know, this undercurrent of stuff that has come out, like the new Tedeschi Trucks record, the new Eric Gales record.
I got to see Eric out at NAMM a few weeks ago. He was fabulous. I haven't had a chance to sit down and listen to the new Tedeschi Trucks record, but a friend of mine said it's phenomenal.
It's rich. It's lush. It's just such an expert album. The new Gary Clark Jr. record.
There's another one.
Holy cow! It is so good. I wrote a blog that was. The only reason I call it great is because I poured my heart into this blog, because when I heard the record, I realized, oh my God, he is so real. So real. And it just, it made me feel so good about the guitar, what he was doing, you know?
Yeah. As I like to say, there is some guys you go see and you can't wait to get home and pick up the guitar.
Oh, yeah.
And there are other guys you see, like Eric Johnson, and you go home and you look at your guitar and you go, why?
Yeah, I hear you. Have you heard the new J.D. Simo record? It's called Off at 11.
I have not. I've not heard it yet.
Oh yeah, when we get off the phone, go check it out. It's astounding. It's I feel like J.D. has finally, you know, realized who his true identity.
Right.
You know, and it's just. It's great. It's a great record. He's playing his ass off, and it's a trio, and his voice is great. It's just a great record. I think, you know, I mean, you know, and then we've got amazing traditional electric blues players like the Sue Foley record, the Ice Queen record that came out last year is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Doyle Bramhall 2's Shades record.
He's so good.
Oh. Really, oh, you know what's coming out, and I've heard it. No one else has heard this yet, except for a few bunch of people in Austin here, is the next Eric Tesmer EP.
Really?
It is phenomenal. Oh, my God.
It has not been released yet?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it is astounding. And his playing, his singing, his songwriting... He's on a whole nother level now. And I ran into him 2 weeks ago, I think it was, at near his rehearsal place. And we were chatting. And I said, so, you know, when's this going to happen? And he said, let me send you a copy and you just tell me what you think. And he is just other level. Like I sent him a message back. I go, this is other level shit right here.
Otherworldly
shit. It's amazing. So yeah, I'm so excited about what these musicians are doing and how they're, you know, it's making me incredibly excited to do this show, play guitar and get out there and do stuff. It's the energy from it all is just phenomenal, you know, and that's the same energy that I felt watching Hired Gun. And I've watched Hired Gun now like 5 times.
It is, and as many times as I've seen it in various phases of its production as well as the finished product, I always get something more out of it each time I watch it.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
And it's unusual because I was so close to it for 3 years.
Right.
And there were a lot of ups and downs through the project. But I get something out of it every single time that I watch it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it circles back around to, you know, the up-and-coming musician. And some people get the break and then it doesn't happen for them.
Right.
You know, like the part in the movie when his name escapes me right now, but it was a really, really funny line in the movie. He's in between tours and opening and he's painting houses for extra money.
Oh, yeah.
And Matt Sorum walks up and he's painting Matt Sorum's house and doesn't know it. And Matt looks at him and goes, "Hey, don't I know you?" He goes, "Yeah, man, we opened for you." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, so how you doing?" "Well, I'm painting your fucking house."
Yeah, that's great. Right. Yeah, he's just sitting on a bucket eating a sandwich. It's what a bummer, man. I've heard that same scenario countless times.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, from guys like that all the way back to, do you remember a band out of Baltimore by the name of Kix, K-I-X?
Yes.
That same thing with them, you know, like the guitar player who was just really brilliant. He went to work for his brother putting up billboards on the interstate, you know?
Yeah. It never happens.
Yeah.
And then you take a guy like John Five, John
mm-hmm.
Lowry,
mm-hmm.
and there's another chameleon,
yeah.
Play absolutely any style, and he grew up with privilege. He could have gone to any college or university that he wanted to, and he just said, "Mom, Dad, I want to be a studio musician. That's what I really want to do."
Amen.
And he never wanted to be a rock star, but there you have it. He's a rock star.
That's a whole trip to me too. Is that he wanted to be a studio cat, and now all of a sudden he's with Rob Zombie.
Yeah, and you know, and Rob, he's such a wonderful guy, and he's funny, and he's very, very intelligent,
really smart. Yeah,
he gets it. He's like, there's just a small handful or two of cats that are on like every record that everybody's ever bought. And yeah. It's a little over exaggerated, but it's not far from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, you look at guys like Luke Lukather, who knows how many.
Oh yeah.
Hundred.
That's a little more literal.
Yeah. Of records he's been on. Ray Parker Jr. The same thing.
Yeah.
You know, those guys are, they're unique in the industry,
yeah.
In terms of their longevity and their ability to play anything at any time.
Yeah, I always look at it as who were the three guys in those three different periods of time, and you know, for those late 50s, 60s, it was Tedesco, and then yep. You know, 70s, it was Carlton, and you know, a little bit of Lee Ritenour, and then the 80s, 90s, and aughts, it was Luke.
Yeah. Definitely Lukather, Ray Parker Jr., of course.
Yeah.
Kenny Aronoff on drums. You got a bunch of cats that are on everybody's records.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really a fraternity of, you know, the interview you did with Waddy, that whole crew of people.
Yeah.
Been together in the 70s and 80s, all playing on everybody's records.
Right.
Waddy and Leland Sklar and Danny right. Korchmar
right.
and Jackson Brown and J.D. Souther and Tim Schmidt and Dan Fogelberg, you know, and, mm-hmm. and they're all on everybody's records.
Yeah, Andrew Gold. And they were all, but they were like a gang. in many respects. Yeah, they were less, it was less of like those hardcore studio cats and more like these guys that were all going to end up in bands while they were doing all those other gigs and end up on a tour somewhere, whether it be with, you know, Stone Pony or whoever. And, you know, so yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And Joe Walsh and Glenn Frey and Don, they were all in there. And I guess the ringleader for that was probably Bill Zimczyk, because I think he produced most of their records in some way, shape, or form. But yeah, and they all hung together. I used to live in Boulder, and right down the street from where Joe Walsh used to live, and they had this cool, funky little recording studio in a small little town called Nederland. It's up above Boulder in a canyon, and it literally is a hideout. And that's where these guys used to all go hang and play.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So there's a part in the movie that really resonated for me and broke my heart, because it's somebody that I really love. I love his playing. He's my favorite drummer of all time. And he's a fellow Long Islander like me. And Liberty DeVito, who was sort of the, you know, he was like the antithesis of a sideman in the sense that, you know, he had a 30-year gig.
Exactly.
You know, and which is like completely unheard of. But as you being a lawyer, what would be the advice you'd give to people that were thinking about becoming a side player or a studio musician on how to make sure that they protect themselves and also prepare for the best and the worst should they decide to go that route and avoid something like what happened to Lib?
Yeah. First and foremost, you really at some point do have to think about representation and legal representation.
Yeah.
A lot of people, and they come into my office all the time where, you know, a producer wants to sign them and it looks good and it sounds good, and they go ahead and they sign, and then they bring the contract to me to read.
Ooh.
And I'm like, why did you sign this? And they're like, well, you know, it says I'm going to get this and I'm going to get that. I'm going to get that. And I was like, this is an evergreen contract. They don't have to do anything. They can just sit back and hope that you make it. And then they're going to cash in.
Right.
And you're going to pay all the production costs. And that's going to be taken away from anything before they've got to recoup before you ever see a nickel. And you may not ever see a nickel. So you've got to have good negotiating. You have to have a good contract that's going to be as fair as you can make it. All right. There are certain things that you'll be able to negotiate. Certain things you won't be able to negotiate. But today's day and age, you've got to hold out for a piece of the pie, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have an interest in your intellectual property. You know, labels will sometimes want to own that. And it's the classic works made for hire scenario that if it's written while you're with us, we own it. Well, I don't think I want to do that. I think I want to own my material, and then we can negotiate what that's worth.
Mm-hmm.
But so many times it doesn't happen that way. In Liberty's case, certain things I can go into, certain things I can't, but there was an agreement that he had with Billy, in the end when he left. The other guys, Russell Jabbers and Doug Stegmaier, they didn't, you know, they just never got called back. And they hear about Billy's new record driving down the highway. And Liberty, of course, was asked to do the record. The other two were not. And so they didn't have the luxury of having anything to fall back on from a legal standpoint. Liv did. He was fortunate in that regard. And we got challenged during the recording of the movie from Billy's people. They tried to shut us down at one point. And it was based on the agreement. And we said, too bad. Here we are. You want to file suit? Go ahead and file suit. But we did all of these interviews in good faith. We had releases, permissions from the artist to do the interviews, to use the interviews. And, hey, Billy, why don't you give us an interview and give us your side of it? And he just flat out refused.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Well, but, you know, as I've had plenty of time to sit back and think about it, I was like, Billy, if you'd have just spoken up and been part of the movie and given your side of things, how many people do you think, Mark, would have gone out and say, you know what? I haven't listened to The Stranger in a while. And they go out and they buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It would increase his record sales, put more money in his pocket.
Yes, probably. Yeah.
And instead he wanted to, you know, act like a big ogre and say, you can't do this. We're going to sue you and we're going to shut you down. And he said, have at it. And nothing ever came of it, but he threatened.
It was that story in the record in the movie is the most gut wrenching for me. You know, I used to when the band wasn't on the road with Billy, they would go out and do shows on Long Island as the Long Island All Stars, and they would play places like in New York, places like the Right Track Inn, which, you know, the Roaches were so big there they served drinks, you know. And it was this just this, you know, little shithole, but it was great. It sounded great. They were great. It was so cool to see these guys doing, you know, and they would do Beatles songs, they'd do Buddy Holly songs. They even played some of their own original material that Russell had and that they had all worked on together. And it was fantastic. It was, you know, so, and you know, you get to because they were in such close proximity to everybody. They were very accessible, and I would always talk with them, Doug particularly, and Lib. And I ran into Lib one time at the Long Island Drum Center, and I was buying a Christmas present for my drummer at the time, and there he is. He shows up, and I went, "Oh my God, Lib, you are my all time favorite drummer. Don't tell my drummer. But you are my all-time favorite drummer." And he looked at me and he says, "Kid, you've got very good taste."
he's like that, you know. And he is still an insane drummer.
Oh, he's amazing.
He is so good.
Yeah.
And he's such a heavy hitter. I mean, I know it's a guitar program, but you got to give the devil his due.
Oh, yeah. Well, for me, you know, and everybody knows who listens to this show, drum, you know, the rhythm section, drums and bass are, I could listen to drums and bass all day long. All the guitar is on top of that is the you know, the chocolate sauce, the accoutrement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They are the ice cream.
It's funny to get a handle on it. You take the two guys and put them in a room together, Kenny Aronoff and Liberty DeVito, and sit back. It's like one of the best comedy routines you've ever heard. Yeah. When they get on.
Who's got the loudest snare drum?
I would say Lib does.
Ah,
and the reason is the following. They were chatting one night over dinner, and Lib said, "Yeah, I broke the top mounting piece on one of the cymbals tonight." And, you know, it's the mechanism that has the felt on it. And
right.
You screw it. And Kenny said, "You what?" He said, "Yeah, I broke it tonight." He goes, "I've never broken one." And Lib looks at him, he goes, "What? You've never broken one?" He goes, "No, I've never broken one." He said, "Have you broken one before tonight?" He goes, "I break two or three every time I play a show." And I was like, "Oh my God." And it's serious as a heart attack. I mean, and when you watch him play in the movie, he's killing it.
Oh,
he's absolutely killing it. He's a very heavy hitter.
Yeah.
Very heavy hitter.
Him and another drummer, I don't know if you know who he is, Joe Franco. You know Joe Franco?
No, I don't.
He was with the Good Rats. And,
oh, the Good Rats. Yeah,
and then he was with Twisted Sister. He did a lot of session work, too. But those two, I don't know what it is about the water on Long Island, but those two drummers to me are still, you know, I mean, it's those two and then Bonham for me.
Okay.
That's
yeah.
how it works for me. But yeah, great drummers, great drummers. And, yeah, you know,
Lib's story is, it's just so powerful and it's so moving. We actually ended up changing the storyline a bit, Mark, because we did some premieres and some private screenings as we developed the project. And what we ended up concluding was we didn't want it to be a film too focused on Billy Joel.
Right.
So there was too much Billy Joel content in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we took some of that out, wrote some of that out, and made it a little more fair-handed, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the backdrop to Russell and Doug not being called back to do the next record was that Billy had lost a ton of money.
Oh, yeah.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And it was a relative of his then wife, Christy Brinkley, that mm-hmm. was managing the band.
Mm-hmm.
And he skimmed a bunch of money and stole a bunch of money. And Billy was paranoid. You know, he just was fed up with everything and decided he was going to go in a different direction. It had harsh consequences, as we know, and I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen the movie. But
and all of that is understandable, and I can empathize absolutely. You know, it's just when the innocent ones get the brunt of that, it's kind of rough.
Yeah, and they've been together for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden you're done,
yeah.
and I'm not even going to tell you. But yeah, and have you seen The Lords of 52nd Street yet?
Not yet, no.
Lib and Russell are traveling around the country and they're playing and they're doing small venues and business as usual, just like the old days.
Neato. I can't wait. I've been hearing about it. I've chatted with Russell a little bit and he's mentioned it and I haven't seen anything yet, so I'm psyched.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So they're enjoying it and it's really, really, really good to see him playing.
That's great.
Russell would be another good guy to have on.
Oh, definitely. At some point it's gonna happen. I tend not to bother people too much. I try not to do that. I don't like to hound them too much. But so you're a guitar player yourself, and you've been playing for many years.
Yeah, a lot of years.
So as a musician, and you were still, you know, cutting your teeth in many respects, you went to, when you decided to become a lawyer, you went to the law school at U of M in Florida.
Yes.
And those were the days of Jocko, Pat Metheny, you know, Steve Morse and those cats, Andy West and cats like that. What was that like?
It was an amazing time to be at the U.
I believe because, it.
Yeah, within like 5 or 6 years, you hit it right on the nose. You had Jocko at the University of Miami School of Music. You had Pat Metheny. You had Steve Morse, Andy Timmons. Hiram Bullock,
oh my
Dave
God.
LaRue, and the UM Jazz Band would be on the patio next to the pool, the campus pool, where all the hotties hung out back in the day.
Uh-huh.
And they had like a half shell, performance shell. And the UM Jazz Band would play every Friday afternoon. And I used to just go out there and just sit and listen and watch these guys play. It was just, it was off the hook. And Andy, I didn't know him at the time, but he was playing in a house band at a place down in Dadeland, which is south of Coral Gables. And we used to go there on Wednesday nights, and I used to watch this guy play, and I was like, wow, he's a really freaking good guitar player. Who is that? Well, it ends, turns out it was Andy Timmons. And I was playing down the street at another place. That's kind of how I put myself through school, was as a solo act, because it was easy. I didn't have to rely on other people. It was decent money, you know, back in the day. I was making $100 a night.
Wow. And that went a long way too.
It went a long way. And so I was, it was a grind though. You know, I was going to law school full time. I'd be there from 8 a.m. Till basically 8 p.m, going to classes, studying and all that stuff. And then I'd go home, I'd grab my guitar, I'd grab my PA, and I played 5 nights a week from 10 until 2 in the morning, going to law school full time. It was a beat down. It was an absolute beat down. But the musical climate then was just fabulous, you know, with that caliber of player being there and being able to see him all the time, you know, literally all the time. Jocko was, he'd show up anywhere, you know, you'd be at a bar listening to music and all of a sudden Jocko would stand up and he wouldn't have any of his gear or anything else. He'd just play whatever was on stage and would be amazing, you know. And then you'd see guys like, you know, of course, Andy, Hiram Bullock was there. He was playing all the time. Pat Metheny and Steve Morse, they kind of took off and did their own things. And Pat was, he was in Boston before he went to UM.
Right.
I'm from up there. So, and I used to see him play all the time when I was up in New England.
Didn't Pat also teach at UM?
Yes.
I thought he did. So. Yeah.
He was there for, I think he was a student for maybe only a year or two. And then he was on the faculty.
Right. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. He's another guy that I absolutely love.
Me too.
You know, the 70s and the 80s, well, more so the 70s for me is when I really got turned on to that type of player. You know, it was Pat Metheny. You had all the fusion guys. Al Dimeola came out, you know, in the 70s and Land of the Midnight Sun. You had Weather Report, of course. Mm-hmm. You had Jocko, you had Stanley Clark. His guitar player for years was David Sanctius. And, you know, all the great jazz fusion records, John McLaughlin, all that stuff. There was a radio station in Boston called WBCN.
Yeah.
And they used to play this stuff all the time. And I got totally hooked on it through the 70s. I was listening to all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's the station that broke Aerosmith. It broke the Cars, right? I mean, you know, Jay Giles was on constant repeat play.
And another guy, more of a regional cult favorite, and I'd still love to see him play when I'm up there, is James Montgomery. Fabulous front man, harp player, great, just great music vibe. And used to see him a lot. He used to do the college circuit up there.
Right.
Jay Giles sold out everywhere they played.
Right.
They were.
So when you mentioned earlier about your work with Jason as his representation, does that also include, because back in the day it was different for me, but does that also include like procuring endorsement deals and stuff like that as well?
Yeah. I always look at them. Sometimes we'll have to negotiate different terms of the deal. You know, with somebody big like Gibson, it's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get an endorsement deal. If you have your own line of products like Jason does, he's got the M4 Sherman Explorer, which is a killer killer playing guitar. Mm-hmm. It's a really different setup from the regular production explorers. But, you know, you get a certain number of units as part of your deal, and then you are able to get artist pricing on, you know, your non signature products. Mm-hmm. So contrary to popular belief, artists pay for their gear.
Yeah. I figured as much because, you know, I never had it. Well, that's not entirely true. I had back in the day, and I don't know if it's still like this now, there were Class A and Class B endorsements. Is that still the case?
No, not so much, especially with somebody like Gibson. You know, if you're on their artist roster, mm-hmm. you will get artist pricing.
Okay.
Whether you're Jason Hook or whether you're you.
Right. Okay. So, like, once for example, I had a deal with Seymour Duncan. So with Seymour Duncan, it was a Class B artist endorsement, but I would get the pickups for free if I took Blems.
Okay.
So that was a sweet deal. That was really a good deal. And then I was with Kaler, Whammy Bars, and that was you know, basically purchasing it wholesale.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And, you know, that's there are different deals with different companies depending on who they are. You know, Ibanez, they're not bashful about giving away their products, mm-hmm. clearly. But they're more the exception than the rule. And some of them are harder to get on than others, right. For sure. But the back to the original question is, yes, I look at all the endorsement deals. I follow up on them. I keep track of the number of units sold. Typically, the royalty checks come through me. Mm-hmm. And so that I'm aware of, you know, how many units he's selling, meaning his guitars. You know, he's got the Epiphone line and he's got the Gibson line.
Right.
So the Epiphones, they actually move really, really well because of the price point.
Sure.
And Epiphone, unlike Gibson, they were not affected by the bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. They were allowed to stay intact. There were no restrictions on them. It's business as usual. Mm-hmm. Their kind of CEO guy, I met him out at NAMM. He's a really, really good guy, nice guy. And he is very, very artist-driven. And he's done really well to move the brand.
Well, I'll tell you, I love what they're doing for 2019. And, you know, if they can, as long as they can dress those frets okay, everything's going to be just hunky dory because it's, I got to tell you, it's a great, they make a great line of stuff,
really.
You know, you know, I mean, from my own personal taste, I just don't like that headstock on the Les Paul. It's just not attractive. But like Jason's Explora is outrageous. It is just beautiful. And folks, if you go to guitarradioshow.com, there'll be a picture of Michael and Jason holding one of the Epiphones. Actually, I think it's something that looks like there was some funky artwork done on there.
Actually, that was there's a whole bunch of videos from that. Jason took a guitar completely blank, and you should see the finished product. But yeah, he did that artwork right then and there on the spot.
Neat.
It's now going to be finished off, and it will be a one-off that will eventually be sold.
Cool.
Yeah, and he picked up his guitar tech. Roy was also there, and he was going through the Epiphones that they had lined up, and he picked up one, and he goes, "Wow, this is way heavier than the other ones." And he handed it to Jason, and Jason's like, "I like the feel of this thing. This is going to have sustain for days." And he turned around, and he goes, "Where can we put this? We want this one now." And he grabbed it right then and there. So that one's going on tour. That one's going to be re-outfitted with pickups and going to go on tour with Jason.
Yeah.
But the M4 Sherman is it's an interesting how it developed, how it evolved. Jason has always liked Explorers, but Death Punch, which most people may not know, guitarists may know, they tuned down B to B, Mark.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Jason's low E string is a 72 gauge.
Oh, my Lord.
72. And because it had to be reworked, the bridges need to be reset. And so when you're tuned down B to B, your leads, you're always living up around the 20th fret. I mean, yeah. That's just where you have to be. And he kept running into the body, you know, and didn't like that. So he took one of his old Explorers and he routed out that bottom horn so that he had more unrestricted access to the entire fretboard.
Sure.
And he also didn't like the kind of the square 90 degree step off like that are on Les Pauls and that are on Explorers. So he beveled off that part of the guitar where your right arm would rest because it was more comfortable. And he hates the pick guard. So he rips the pick guard off and, well, I got to do something to cover the electronics. So he took some conduit and put the wires that run up to the toggle switch, ran it through that. So then to really make it unique, he had routed out part of the back of the guitar and he took a piece of a Sherwood hockey stick and inserted it on the back of the Explorer, kind of almost like a handle, you know, like by his gem.
Right.
And so it originally was called Sherwood, his Explorer, because it literally had a piece of a Sherwood hockey stick on. He still has it. It's, you know, beat to crap, but it sounds great. And the Sherman was a logical, you know, progression from that because he is a history buff. And so that's kind of how that whole concept came into being. Right. But it's a really killer guitar. The custom shop makes it for him. It's got a quarter sawn neck, which I swear by them. You know, once my tech explained it to me, you know, with flat sawn neck, you know, the vibrations get interrupted as they travel up the neck of the guitar because of the grain.
Yeah.
But when you have a quarter sawn neck, the grain runs the full length of the neck. And so the sound, the vibration travels uninhibited. It made sense to me. And then he said, took two guitars out, exactly the same. One was quarter sawn, one wasn't. And you hear the way they resonate, you go, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
So he's got a quarter sawn neck. You can't see it because it's painted. And he's got a Grenadillo fingerboard, which is similar to rosewood. He stole some of Zach's Uber jumbo fret wire when he was at the shop. He's like, I like the frets on Zach's guitars. Give me some of that fret wire. And so he had them put that on there. And then he has a 59 in the neck and a JB in the bridge.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. See, I expected something hotter than that. That's interesting.
Well, he's got a couple that he has hot rodded, but they're Duncan pickups. He just had Seymour have the output be higher. So, yeah, his bridge pickup it's probably somewhere up, probably somewhere close to 17K output. It's pretty darn
good. Jeez, holy cow.
Yeah, it's pretty thin.
It's like you put a megaphone in the guitar.
Yeah.
Before you even got to the amp.
You know, and the other interesting thing he's done, I know it's kind of a segue here, but talking about gear and things and using him as the example. Remember several years, not several, but probably 3 or 4 years ago, the two hottest things out were the Dave Friedman amps, and the other were Fractals.
Right.
Everybody was going with Fractals. Well, why? Because when you're in Europe and you're dealing with a different current, all that other kind of crap, you want something that you just throw it on the floor and you play it and it sounds the same every night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's something to be said for that, but Jason's kind of a tone snob as well. And he's come back full circle, and he's now taking heads and cabinets on the road because he likes the sound better.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a lot to pick from. He traditionally had been a JCM 800 guy for years. I bought him a Friedman stack when they were hot, and he liked it. Didn't take it out on the road, but he liked it. And then for the last tour and for the upcoming tour, guess what he's playing on? He's taken two 5150s on the road with him.
Huh.
Yeah, I said, really? He's like, yeah. He said, I took all my heads out. I A-beat them. These things are just punchy, ballsy. I love the way they feel, love the way they sound. So he's running them through cabinets that are armed with vintage 30s.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't make that jump for a while, though, because I was looking at his cabinets one day. I was like, dude, why do you have these 75s in there? He's like, I don't know. You know, they sound fine. I was like, oh, no. You got to put some vintage 30s in this cabinet and then compare it and tell me what you think. So he goes ahead and he does that, and he calls me up. He goes, dude, you were fucking right. These vintage 30s sound amazing. I was like, yeah, I can't believe you've been playing with those, what are they, GT 75s for so long.
Yeah, really.
He finally got with the program. He's using vintage 30s.
That's good. Yeah, better breakup. Much better breakup.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
So let's talk about your gear here for a sec. I've got this really cool shot of this really sweet Stratocaster.
Yes.
I believe her name is Nadine.
Nadine is my number one. She was lovingly crafted out of all custom parts. It took me a while to find the right body. And when I did, it's a really nice resonant beat to crap strap body.
Mm-hmm.
And I then ordered a custom Warmoth neck.
Quarter sawn,
of course. And it's got an asymmetrical neck profile a la Stevie Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put 6100 fret wire on it. I got vintage hardware to put on it. I got a John Mann trem. It's called man-made. John used to make the trems for PRS. And, of course, as we all know, Paul will use a vendor for a while and study the design of that, and then he'll come up with his own. And so he makes his own. He makes his own now. But John's based out of Bedford, New Hampshire, and just makes fabulous trems in this old style. And then I put in – this is the secret weapon of Nadine. It's like – put in a set of Jason Lawler Dirty Blondes.
Mm.
People play it and they go, what's in this thing? It's like, Jason Lawler Dirty Blondes. Who's Jason Lawler? What the heck are Dirty Blondes?
Oh, come on. People say, who's Jason Lawler?
Yeah. And I'm like, really? It's like, everybody's heard of Lindy Fralin, and I love him too. And I'm,
oh, yeah.
But, you know, Lawler is like, he's the dude, and I got turned on to him. I had a Bill Nash back in the early 2000s because I liked the relic look and everything.
Right. And the Lawlers came stock in the Nashes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I had it, and I was like, this thing sounds freaking amazing. What's in it? And did the research and found out, and I called them up. I said, can I get a set of those? They're like, yeah, dude. Wow. So I ordered my Lawler Dirty Blondes, and that's what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
The logo is a Fender logo. It's a funny story. Was it the Dallas International Guitar Festival? And I was on a quest to get the Fender logo. And I was asking around for some of the, you know, the used parts and all that kind of stuff. It's like, who's got them? He says, go see that guy over there. And I walk over and I said, so somebody told me you may have some Fender logos, headstock logos. And he looks around, he goes, are you with Fender? I was like, no. He said, well, they're around at these shows because, you know, it's really highly illegal and, you know, they don't like it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay. He says, wait right here. And he goes down below the table and he comes up with this binder with plastic sheets in it. And he sidles up to me and gets real close to me, shoulder to shoulder. And he opens it and was looking around, like, you know, it's like we're doing a dope deal or something, you know. He's like this? And I was like, yeah, exactly like that. He said, $20. I said, okay. He said, no, don't hand me the money here. So he brings it over to the side of the table, you know, and he puts it down. He's looking around. I slide the 20 over. He puts his hand over it, and he puts it in his pocket and walks away, and I grab my logo. So so it does have a real Fender logo.
That's great. It's like the Fender police.
You with Fender? It's like, no. He said, well, they busted me before.
That's great. That's great. That is once I started going to the Dallas Guitar Festival, I realized I never wanted to go back to NAMM ever again.
NAMM is a lot.
It's too much.
The first 3 hours, my head felt like it was going to explode off my shoulders.
Yeah, well, 95 dB. On a constant basis is not good for the ecosystem of the human being. I'm sorry. No. It's just
and not. I immediately went down one of the aisles to Eargasm and got some,
yeah,
you know, $10 earplugs, not the little foam ones.
Right.
What a difference it made. But yeah, you don't realize it's as louder than a concert.
Well, they say that 95 dB is as loud as a passing subway train. But constant.
Yeah, constant. But 4 days of that was this year. I mean, I went out because I had a number of clients that were out there, and I figured I hadn't been in a while. I'll go.
Right.
I had fun, but I'll never do 4 days again.
Yeah. The Dallas show, on the other hand, is just so much fun. And there's the shows, and you can go to all the different stages. You can go and check out some different clinics. You can shop. You can meet up with a lot of people that you know, friends of yours, and it's just a blast. And now you're going to be there this year, right?
Absolutely.
So we'll finally get to meet you in the flesh.
I saw Jimmy Wallace last week.
Uh-huh.
He was playing with Junior Clark here in Dallas, and we were chatting about that, and he's got an idea. He loved Hired Gun, and he said, we're actually thinking about putting together a little documentary on the Dallas International Guitar Festival.
Oh. It's
like, cool. And he's like, I need to have one of your cards because you already know how to do this. So we'll see how that pans out.
Yeah. That would be a great doc because it's a great story. I mean, you know, I mean, yeah. 40, that's going to be 42 years this year or 41?
Yeah.
42 years. Yeah, man, that's crazy. That is crazy.
I got to tell you, last week he had one of the best sounding Marshalls I've ever heard.
Yeah.
It sounded so good. And I was like, Jimmy, that amp sounds amazing. And he looked at me and he smiled. He goes, yeah, I got a bunch of them too. I'm going to work on him to see if I can pry one of them out of his fingers.
Oh, man. I got to tell you. So what's next for you? What's coming up for you?
What's next for me is actually we're gaining some traction, Mark, on there being a series as a spinoff of Hired Gun.
Really? So what,
and it's
going to be what?
Never been done. See, we've got probably 300 hours of footage.
Wow.
and it's an hour and 38 minute movie.
Yeah.
So there are so many artists that never made it into the film that all have great stories. They just aren't the ones that came to the front. And thank our film editor, Tim Calandrello, who, I mean, he's the one that wrote the story from all the footage. You know, he went through it and said, this is the stories that ring, you know, that we want to bring forward. You know, Liberty was one. Rudy was another one. Jason is another one. Of course, you know, him being executive producer. And then there were, you know, some smaller stories that also came through that as well. But we've got some interest. Netflix is interested. They're one of the ones that are carrying the Hired Gun film.
Yeah.
And how many seasons could we do with 300 hours of footage?
It could go for a while.
It could go for a while. Well. And nothing like this has ever been done. So we've got an idea. We've got a plan. Tim is definitely going to be in charge of the day-to-day. He did a phenomenal job with Hired Gun, and he's a proven entity, you know, mm-hmm. and he's Grammy nominated a couple of times, and he's our guy for sure.
Very cool. That is great. Yeah. Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
And when would we know that that's actually going to go down?
We're in the negotiating phases now,
actually. Oh, cool. That is fantastic.
It's a tedious process.
Yeah.
As we learned from the first film. And once that occurs, we'll immediately start going into production.
Oh, man, neat. Yeah. That's super cool.
And we've got a lot of archival footage, obviously, like I said, but 300 hours worth. I mean, Neil Sean never made it into the movie.
Yeah, and there was very little on John 5, and a couple other people, you know, it was just, they were kind of like a splash in there. So,
I mean, you could do a whole series just with Lukather.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, just talking about Sessions alone. Yeah, you know what I want to hear him talk about is the steakhouse sessions. Are you familiar with this?
No.
Okay. He got hired. I have the steakhouse sessions on CD. I got it through a friend of a friend of a friend. It is, and the quality's phenomenal.
Grateful Dead tapes.
No, he was producing. He was in talks, and it was of them trying to, you know, Jeff Beck is his favorite guitar player, as is mine. And he was going to produce a Jeff Beck record. And he and Jeff are in the studio, and it's all the tunes that they wrote and recorded to whatever level they recorded them. Yeah, at the Steakhouse in L.A. And it's just called Jeff Beck Steakhouse Sessions, but he's all over it.
Wow.
Luke is all over it, and he, you know, I mean, he's a monster. But to hear them play together, it's astounding. And I don't know whatever happened, why it never came to fruition. I mean, that happens with lots of projects, I know.
Yeah.
But this is phenomenal. Yeah.
How long ago was that?
Oh, it's got to be in the early 2000s.
Mm. I wonder why.
I don't know, but it's phenomenal.
I'll be looking for that. Well,
I will tell you what. Let's talk when we get off mic.
That sounds good.
Well, man, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. And this was—I knew this was going to be a great talk. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. And you did not disappoint.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. It really was an honor and a privilege to be on your show, and thank you for inviting me and giving us another opportunity to chat.
Absolutely, and I look forward to meeting you face-to-face, and maybe we do a little jamming at Casa de Balicki.
That would be awesome, and I know that if we do that, there will be some good food prepared by Iron Chef Charlie.
Absolutely. You hear that, Jason? You hear that, Charlie Bear? we're looking for something out of the smoker, and we'll do the smoking on the guitars. And I believe Signor Balducci will be joining us as well.
So. He will be joining us. We were we were the three amigos out at NAMM for the most part for 3 days.
I'm sure.
And I know Rob is already got his application and everything in for Dallas.
Good. Yeah. I'm so glad that he you know, I remember when Mr. Laredo reached out. And he goes, where should we go in Texas? I said, you guys should be playing the Dallas Guitar Festival. Why Balducci is not at the Guitar Festival is beyond me. I says, here's the guy to talk to. Talk to this guy. And they went and they did it. And I thought for sure it wasn't going to happen, I'll be honest. But because, you know, you never know with Jimmy. And it happened. And he's back every year now. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah, so it'd be fun. You, me, Jason, Andre, and Signor Balducci will tear it up.
That sounds great.
I was already told by Jason I have to bring my own amp.
Well, I probably can get you covered there.
I'll just bring a Princeton, that's all. That'll be fun. That'll do it. Well, thank you, man. It was, like I said, so great to talk to you. We're going to sign off right here, but you hold on 1 second because I want to talk to you about the steakhouse.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks, man.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and, of course, on guitarradioshow.com.